I have a confession to make about philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
When I think about the very first philosophers, the guys way, way back before Socrates, I have this really specific mental image.
Let me guess. Old Greek men in togas.
Exactly. Guys in togas sitting around staring at puddles or campfires, trying to figure out the periodic table before the periodic table even existed.
That is the classic stereotype, honestly. You've got Thales saying everything is water, Heraclitus saying everything is fire.
Right.
And in the history books, we usually label them the pre-Socratics, and we just treat them like primitive scientists.
Like they were trying to do physics, but they just didn't have microscopes yet.
Precisely.
And it feels like they were just guessing, Is it atoms? Is it air? Is it water? And honestly, it is hard to see why that matters to us today. It just feels like bad science from 2,500 years ago.
It does, but we have a stack of research here today, specifically a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes, which suggests we have been looking at them completely wrong.
Or at least we're missing the actual point of what they were doing.
It is a massive oversight. If you only look at these guys as proto-scientists, you miss the entire engine driving their thought.
Because they weren't just asking what the world is made of physically.
No, they were asking a much more desperate question, really. They were asking, is the world fair?
Which is a huge shift. You're saying we need to move from physics to ethics.
Exactly. The thesis we're exploring on this deep dive is that these thinkers were actually pre-theological. They were obsessed with this idea of cosmic justice.
Cosmic justice.
Yeah. They believed the universe wasn't just some cold physical machine, but an actual moral system where justice is as natural and inevitable as gravity.
Which is a fascinating concept for sure, but it sounds a bit wishful, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, the idea that if you drop a rock, it falls, and if you commit a crime, the universe naturally corrects it, that feels like a stretch.
It definitely sounds wishful to modern ears, but that is the mission for our deep dive today. We are going to trace this whole arc of cosmic justice.
Okay, where do we start?
We'll start with the poets. They wrote the textbooks these philosophers learned from. Then we'll move to the thinkers who saw morality in the mechanics of nature and end with the ultimate showdown between mind and chance.
So let's unpack this. To understand these philosophers, you're saying we have to go back even further. Before the guys talking about water and fire, there were the storytellers.
You cannot understand Greek philosophy without understanding Greek poetry. It was their education system.
Right, there was no philosophy 101.
Exactly. There was Homer and Hesiod.
The Iliad and the Odyssey. We all know the basic gist, but how does that actually relate to justice?
Well, if you really look at the Iliad, what kind of universe do you see? You see gods who are fickle, arbitrary, and frankly, completely indifferent to human suffering.
Yeah, the gods in the Iliad are basically superpowered reality TV stars.
That is a perfect way to put it.
They're cheating on each other, picking favorites, causing wars just because they're bored. It's not exactly a solid moral framework.
It's worse than that. It's terrifying. Imagine living in a world where the most powerful beings in the universe might destroy your city just because Hera is jealous of Aphrodite.
So there's no justice there.
There is only power. And the human heroes, like Achilles, they are much better.
Achilles is basically a moody teenager with a sword, right?
He is totally obsessed with his own status. Aristocracy, wealth, honor. The heroes of the Iliad generally ignore the suffering of the common people.
It's a universe where might makes right.
Yes. If you are strong, you take what you want. If you are weak, you suffer.
So there's no cosmic justice at all. It's just the law of the jungle.
Exactly. But then you get a vibe shift. In the Odyssey, things start to change.
Odysseus's son is back home trying to keep order.
And the goddess Athena steps in specifically to secure justice. The gods are actually starting to care about right and wrong.
But the real breakthrough comes with a poet named Hesiod, really.
Yes. Hesiod changes the game completely with his work, Works and Days. In his view, Zeus isn't just some powerful sky king anymore.
He's stepping into a new role.
He is actually in charge of human affairs in a moral sense. And he has a daughter named Dike.
Decay.
Yes, it literally translates to justice. She watches over mortals. And Hesiod draws this incredibly sharp line between humans and animals.
I have this quote right here from the source, and it is visceral. He says, "Fish, flesh, fowl, each other may devour, for right is not in them."
But right, Zeus gave to men.
Exactly. But hold on, let me push back on that for a second.
Well,
Fish, flesh, fowl, each other may devour. Isn't he just describing the food chain?
he is.
Like sharks eat seals. That's not evil, that's just lunch.
Correct. It's not evil for the shark. That is Hesiod's entire point. Animals eat each other because they don't have decay.
They don't have the capacity for justice.
But humans, we are different. We have a kind of moral software installed by the divine.
So if a human acts like a shark, if a strong man just takes from a weak man, he isn't being powerful, he's actually de-evolving.
Exactly. He is lowering himself to the level of a beast. Hesiod is saying that the law of the jungle applies to the jungle, but not to the city.
And he gives a guarantee for this, doesn't he?
He does. He says that justice always triumphs in the end. He calls it the work of Cronus's son.
Which acts as a metaphor for time.
Right. Time ensures justice.
It's almost like karma, but overseen by a god. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
It is very close to that idea. If a city is just, it prospers. If it turns to violence, Zeus punishes it. It's a higher law.
And you see this later in Sophocles' play, Antigone.
Yes. Remember, she defies the king's order to leave her brother unburied.
Right. The king says leave him to rot, and she buries him anyway.
And her defense is pure cosmic justice. She tells the king that his laws, human laws, cannot override the unwritten, unproclaimed laws of heaven.
Okay, so that sets the cultural backdrop. You have these poets establishing that there is a right and wrong woven into the fabric of the world.
Yes.
But how do we get from there to the philosophers?
Yeah.
How do we get to the guys measuring the stars?
That is the pivot. The philosophers take this poetic intuition, this idea that justice is real, and they try to find it in the physical machinery of the universe.
They stop talking about Zeus and decay and start talking about natural laws.
Exactly. Let's look at Anaximander. He's usually the guy associated with the infinite or the boundless.
Right.
But listen to how he describes nature. He says, things come into being and are destroyed according to necessity. But then he adds this weird legal phrase.
Oh, I have it here. He says, they pay penalty and retribution to each other for their injustice according to the assessment of time.
Penalty and retribution.
That sounds like a courtroom.
It really does.
But wait, he's talking about nature, right? Is he saying if the sun shines too bright, it gets a speeding ticket?
Not a ticket, but a correction. Right. He's talking about the balance of opposites, hot and cold, wet and dry.
So summer commits an injustice against winter by being too hot and taking up too much time.
Yes. So time forces it to pay retribution by yielding to the cold of winter.
Okay, so he's projecting human legal concepts onto the weather.
Or he thinks the legal concepts come from the weather. He sees nature as a self-balancing scale.
It's a cosmic court where balance is always restored.
If one element gets too arrogant, too powerful, the universe smacks it back down.
So nature is inherently fair.
Inherently balanced. And this leads us to Pythagoras. Now, everyone knows him from high school geometry, the triangles.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared, the nightmare of every 10th grader.
But Pythagoras was much more than a math teacher. He founded what was essentially a countercultural commune. Some might even call it a cult.
A math cult.
A math and morality cult. They lived together, they had strict dietary rules, and they were obsessed with living a harmonious life.
For Pythagoras, the universe was a battleground between two forces, right? Paras and Aperon.
Yes.
Paras and Aperon, those sound like transformers. Break those down for me.
Paras is limit, order, definition. Aperon is the unlimited, the chaotic, the undefined. Pythagoras believed that the good life and the good universe comes from imposing limit onto the unlimited.
So drawing lines in the chaos.
Precisely. Reason puts boundaries on life. And this brings us to some of those weird rules the Pythagoreans had.
Yeah, I saw these in the notes, and I have to be honest, they sound like OCD. Rules like restrain your tongue and stir not the fire with iron.
And spit on your nail parings?
Spit on your nail parings. It sounds insane, doesn't it? It sounds like something my grandmother would say to prevent bad luck.
It definitely sounds ritualistic.
How does spitting on my fingernails help me understand the cosmos?
Well, think about the logic of Paris Limit. Take the rule, stir not the fire with iron. Why do you use a wooden handle on a poker?
Because if you touch the iron directly to the fire and hold the iron, you get burned.
Right. Reason dictates you use a limit the wood to handle the dangerous element. It's a metaphor.
I see.
You don't use the iron of passion to stir up conflict. You use the limit of reason.
So it's training.
It is hyper mindfulness. Pythagoras believed the universe is rational and precise. If you are sloppy in your life, if you just leave your fingernails on the floor or you speak without thinking, you are introducing chaos into the order.
They were trying to align their personal lives with the mathematical harmony of the cosmos.
That is exactly it.
That is so much deeper than just triangles. It's about control.
It connects the microcosm of your life to the macrocosm of the universe.
So we have nature as a courtroom with Anaximander.
Yeah.
And we have math as a moral boundary with Pythagoras. But what about the gods?
What do you mean?
Because if these philosophers are finding order in nature, do they still need those fickle, cheating gods from Homer?
That is the next major step, cleaning up the gods. And the man for this job is Xenophanes.
Xenophanes. The notes here say he was a bit of a satirist.
He was a massive critic. He looked at the stories of Homer and Hesiod, the theft, the adultery, the lying gods, and he basically said, "This is ridiculous. You are making the divine look like the worst kind of humans."
I love his argument about the cow god.
It is a brilliant thought experiment. He says, if oxen and horses and lions had hands and could paint, horses would paint gods like horses and oxen like oxen.
That's a great point. He's saying we're just projecting ourselves.
Yes. He points out that Ethiopians have black gods, Thracians have red-haired, blue-eyed gods. We create God in our own image.
So Xenophanes wipes that slate clean.
He proposes a single god who is completely unlike mortals.
So no body, no blue eyes, no jealousy.
No. This god sees as a whole, thinks as a whole, hears as a whole. He doesn't run around fighting wars. He moves the universe just by thinking, without toil.
That is a massive upgrade in sophistication. We're moving toward a rational, abstract deity.
It's the move from mythology to theology. And this sets the stage for Heraclitus.
Heraclitus, the guy who said you can't step in the same river twice.
That is his famous line on change. But his most important contribution to this topic is the concept of the logos.
The logos. That's a heavy word. It means reason or word, right?
Yes. For Heraclitus, the logos is the universal law of reason that governs everything. It's the formula behind the universe. And he uses a fascinating metaphor to explain how humans relate to it. Awake versus asleep.
Those awake have one ordered universe in common. In sleep, each turns away to his own world.
Think about that. When you are dreaming, you are in a private reality. The rules only apply to you. You are the main character, and physics doesn't matter.
But when you wake up, you enter the shared world, the real world.
So he's saying most people are walking around asleep. They live by their own private subjective understandings. My truth, so to speak.
That sounds suspiciously like modern social media. Everyone in their own filter bubble.
It is very similar. Heraclitus would say that to be awake is to recognize the logos. It is to recognize that there's a universal moral order that binds us all.
And if you ignore that order, if you think you can make up your own rules, you're just sleepwalking.
Exactly.
And he also has that idea that war is the father of all, right?
Yeah.
Which sounds contradictory if we're talking about order.
It sounds chaotic, but he means tension, like a bow and a lyre. The string has to be pulled in opposite directions to create tension.
And that tension allows the arrow to fly or the music to play.
Right. Conflict creates harmony. The logos manages that tension.
The source material here mentions a parallel to Christianity, specifically the Gospel of John.
It is impossible to miss. The Gospel of John begins, "In the beginning was the Logos." The early Christians picked up on this Greek idea.
They saw Christ as the embodiment of that universal reason that Heraclitus was groping for.
Precisely.
So we've got this trajectory. Poetry establishes justice. Philosophers find it in nature. Xenophanes cleans up the God concept. And Heraclitus identifies a universal reason.
It feels like we're building toward something big.
We are. We're building toward the ultimate showdown, the clash between mind and chance. This is where the road forks and Western philosophy splits in two.
Let's get into it. In one corner, we have Anaxagoras.
Anaxagoras. He introduces the concept of nous, mind. Not nous like a rope, but N-O-U-S.
Correct. Nous, Anaxagoras looks at the mess of the universe and says, there is no way this just happened. He believes in a teleology. A purpose.
But how does his mind work? Is it a creator god, like in Genesis?
Not exactly. And the distinction is important. He doesn't believe in creation ex nihilo out of nothing. He believes the stuff of the universe, the seeds, the chaos was always there. But it was a mess, a vortex.
A primal revolution.
Right. And Nous's mind acted as the architect. It didn't make the bricks, but it drew the blueprints and organized the pile into a building.
Mind is infinite, self-ruling, and pure.
It separated the chaos into an ordered cosmos.
The Romans loved this guy, right?
Cicero called Anaxagoras the first thinker to say the universe was designed by the rational power of an infinite mind.
But there's always a bug with these philosophers. Plato wasn't fully satisfied.
No, Plato was a tough critic. He thought Anaxagoras didn't go far enough. Anaxagoras explained order how things are arranged, but he didn't fully explain purpose.
He didn't explain why it was arranged that way for the good.
Right. But still, Anaxagoras represents the peak of this intelligent order path.
And then, in the other corner, the challenger.
Democritus.
The materialist foil. The man who looks at Anaxagoras' mind and laughs.
So Democritus looks at the stars, the seasons, the math, and he just says, nope.
He says, show me the mind. He says, there is no nous and no logos. There are only atoms and the void.
Which, to be fair, sounds a lot like modern physics. Atoms bouncing around in empty space.
It is the foundation of modern materialism, but you have to accept the cost of that view. Democritus argues that the universe is just mechanism. It is a whirl of necessity and chance collisions.
And here is where the cosmic justice idea hits a brick wall. Because if the universe is just crashing atoms with no moral arc, what is the meaning of life?
That is the question. If Democritus is right, then justice isn't real. It's just a word we made up. The universe doesn't care if you are a saint or a murderer. It's just atoms colliding.
That is bleak. It is the ultimate freedom, but also the ultimate emptiness. And this leads Democritus to hedonism. If there is no higher law, the goal of life is simply enjoyment.
He says, people are fools who live without enjoyment.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I like enjoyment. If I'm just a pile of atoms, why shouldn't I just try to feel good?
You can, but then you run into the happy cabbage argument.
The happy cabbage. I love this image.
It cuts to the core of it. As Dr. Holmes points out in the source, if pleasure is the only standard, if feeling good is the only metric of a successful life, then you might as well call a healthy cabbage happy or a pig wallowing in mud.
So if I just sit on the couch and eat potato chips and I'm happy, I'm basically just a very complicated vegetable.
According to Anaxagoras or Heraclitus.
Yes.
They would say you are functioning, but you aren't human. You are asleep. You aren't participating in the logos.
But for Democritus.
The pig in the mud is winning the game just as much as the philosopher.
So this is the synthesis. We have two diverging paths established way back in ancient Greece. Path A is Anaxagoras and Heraclitus.
Path A, an ordered, law-governed universe, a place where justice will out, where reason rules and humans have a duty to align with that reason.
And path B is Democritus.
Path B, a mechanistic universe, chance, atoms, no inherent meaning. Might makes right, or pleasure is king.
And really, we're still arguing about this today.
We are. We treat these guys like they are ancient history. But they set the entire agenda for Western philosophy. They frame the debate between materialism and intelligent order that Plato and Aristotle would step into.
And that we are still debating in universities and coffee shops right now.
Exactly. They weren't just looking at the stars. They were looking for a moral compass in the stars.
It is amazing to think that these water and fire guys were actually laying down the tracks for everything that followed. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to go back to that idea from Heraclitus.
The idea of being awake versus asleep.
Right. Living in the common logos versus your private dream. In our modern world, with our curated algorithms and our filter bubbles, we are more disconnected from a common world than ever.
It is a total fragmentation of reality.
Everyone has their own news, their own facts, their own truth. So the question is, if Heraclitus is right, and there is a shared moral order, are we actually living in that reality?
Or have we all retreated into the private dreams of our own individual truths?
Are we awake? Or are we just sleepwalking through a universe we refuse to understand?
Yeah.
Something to think about next time you look up at the stars.